A key component of the modern world economy, the chemical industry delivers products and innovations to enhance everyday life. It is also an industry in transformation, where chemical executives and workers are delivering growth and industry-changing advancements while responding to pressures from investors, regulators, and public opinion. Discover how leading companies are approaching these challenges here on The Chemical Show. Join Victoria Meyer, president of Progressio Global and host of The Chemical Show, as she speaks with executives across the industry and learns how they are leading their companies to grow, transform, and push industry boundaries on all frontiers. Here's your host, Victoria Meyer.
Hi, I'm Victoria Meyer, host of The Chemical Show. This week, I am delighted to be speaking with John Richardson, who is a senior consultant at ICIS. John's been working in petrochemicals and actually the plastics and covering polyolefins for years. And if you follow John at all on LinkedIn or on any of the ICIS publications, you know that he's got a really deep and interesting view on what's going on globally in polyolefins. So I was delighted to be able to bring John on and just talk about the world of plastics today, polyethylene, polypropylene, and petchem and wherever we go. So John, welcome to The Chemical Show.
Thank you, Victoria.
Yeah, awesome. So why don't you just tell us, there may still be a few people in our universe that are not familiar with ICIS. So can you just give us a real quick highlight about what IS is and what they do?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, our heritage goes back to magazines in the 1960s. They no longer exist, of course, hard copy magazines. But our big sort of breakthrough growth was when we acquired a price reporting business in Paris in the 1990s. That was ICIS LOR, is what it was called in those days, many years ago.
I remember that, actually. Yeah, the LOR piece of it. Yeah.
That's the London Oil Report. So we were, you know, doing price reporting, in objective independent price reporting in petchems for the first time ever. So we led the way, and that grew enormously. So we got a huge office in Singapore, in Houston, in London, doing loads of petrochemicals weekly, even daily now. You know, it's become daily for some petrochemicals as the market's got more volatile. But we've also expanded in a major way into news, ICIS News, and then into analytics, which is about 12, 13 years ago. So we've got short-term analytics, supply and demand analysis, you know, live disruption trackers, all sorts of products that are monitoring the global markets, and consulting as well. I should say, very importantly, we do consulting. So it's grown a lot in the last 20-odd years.
Awesome. And then, John, your focus is really, at least the parts that I see of you, is really in polyolefins. It looks like polyethylene, polypropylene. So can you tell us how you got into that?
Good question. I mean, I moved to Singapore in 1997 to deputy editor of a magazine, which no longer exists, on petrochemicals. And I kind of chose polyolefins, having talked to people, friends in the industry, said, look, it's a really important industry. It's a huge part of petrochemicals. Go for it. And it's easier than aromatics.
That's probably true, actually.
So I'll go for that. And, you know, since I was a journalist first, but about 13 years ago, I became a consultant. So it's really looking at Asia Pacific, a lot on China. I try to look at it globally as well. It's the usual stuff, you know, supply and demand analysis, price forecasting, and trying to predict the future.
We're all trying to predict the future.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's just jump in. What the heck is going on in the world of polyolefins today? Give us a brief overview of what's going on in the world.
Weird. I mean, I've never seen markets like this. If you look at our price history going back 20-odd years, never seen Asia so cheap versus US and Europe so expensive. Latin America's more expensive, a lot more expensive. So it's West versus East. So we talk about the West first. As you know much better than me, we had the huge storms in the winter. All that US capacity, 80% polyolefins capacity down at one point. Our CDI team in the US are saying it's beginning to get back to normal. It's just about back to normal now. Taking a long time. You've had all the issues about reduced refinery op rates because of the pandemic. You know, the jet fuel's gone, obviously, and there's not as much propylene around for the US. Same in Europe.
Yeah.
And naphtha as well, of course, with the refineries. Europe, you've got refineries closing down for long-term reasons. All the extra force majeures in all the plants. And underlining that is really strong demand. So I think the world's divided in that Well, I mean, if you go back to April last year, we were all doom and gloom, weren't we? I was wrong. I think a lot of people I spoke to in the industry, we were comparing what was happening economically with the global financial crisis, and we were wrong because despite the huge collapse of GDP, the pandemic has led to stronger demand. So we got people eating at home rather than restaurants. That means more surface area demand for polymers. We've got the, you know, the pandemic, of course, all the hygiene stuff, low moldy HDPE bottles, peeping on over masks, go on, can't you? And that's here to stay, isn't it? You've got, I think there's a big drive on internet sales. And despite all sustainability stuff, there's a mountain of packaging that goes into internet sales.
There is so much packaging. I bear witness to that on a weekly basis as I'm putting out recycling and wondering why I have so many boxes and bags and what have you.
And yeah, exactly. We saw that in China in 2014, this huge boom in internet sales, which led to a huge boom in polyethylene demand in particular. And despite a brief economic downturn in China in 2015, that demand just gone up. And I think that's happening in the West through now. People buy more online for safety reasons, obviously, or shutdown reasons. But now it's convenience, isn't it? People get used to it. So I see those markets as snug. Now let's go to the developing world, focusing on my area of Asia. The demand fundamentals are very different because in Asia Pacific or Southeast Asia, you've only got three developed economies. You've got Australia, New Zealand, Singapore. So let's ignore them. They behave like the US in terms of demand fundamentals. Cash-rich middle classes, regardless of the progress of the pandemic, will always be all right financially. Loads of government stimulus, lots of underlying strong demand. Developing world, you know, you've traveled through the developing world a lot. People have been pushed into extreme poverty by the pandemic because of the poor vaccination rates to the point where you cannot afford a whole bottle of shampoo, quite literally. You're on less than $1.90 a day. And then another dynamic is a lot of people have been denied the opportunity of moving into middle income status, getting up the income tree.
Well, how have they been denied, though? Is this pandemic related or just systemic?
Yeah, it's pandemic related because the vaccination rates in Indonesia is about 10%, about 9% in India, for example. Indonesia being the fourth most populous country in the world, you know. You've got huge economic damage because all the day rate laborers can't work. So these are people who get paid cash every day. The reason why lockdowns are really severe is because of weak healthcare systems. So, you know, it's like vicious circle. Unlike the West, the cost of financing for developing countries has gone up, become more expensive. So it's hard for governments to borrow money, to just throw money at people the way that we've done in the West. In Australia, the low-paid workers, the apprentices in Australia, were better off during the pandemic than when they were working.
Because of unemployment compensation and stuff.
That's what they call job furlough schemes, they call it. It's like the checks that you can get in the US, the same thing.
Yeah, we've had some of the same stuff, yeah.
You know, so low-paid workers, better off. It's a huge extreme poverty effect, and that means the dynamic has changed because normally you see this great demand growth of polyolefins in the developing world every year. Tremendous growth.
Right. I mean, that's a lot of the growth is hinged on the fact that the developing world needs to kind of catch up to consumption rates. Not that it'll ever, maybe will, but it got much higher growth. Yeah.
Exactly. And the per capita consumption is so far behind the US and Australia, it's, you know. And so that means we're probably going to have a second year of negative growth in the developing world, I think, including Asia Pacific, minus those rich economies I talked about. So that's a big deal. And then there's the huge bear in the corner of the room, China, which is like, I mean, it's 43% of global polypropylene demand. It's 30-odd% of polyethylene demand. It's five times bigger than the next country in terms of consumption. I mean, this is enormous. I mean, China became this giant around 2008-09 when it overtook North America and Europe in terms of volume terms. And what you've seen in China, again, is there's a slowdown in China in the first half of this year, the first 7 months, actually, looking at the latest data that came out yesterday, versus the last 7 months of last year. Now, this is not the end of the world. China's still fine. But the reason is that huge export growth they enjoyed in the last 7 months of last year has come off the boil. Their exports, manufactured exports, were down 20% in H1 this year versus the second half of last year. Semiconductor shortages, container shortages. So it's the difficulty of getting their stuff to market. It's stuck somewhere. Demand is there. Demand is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this is not a demand issue. It's a logistics and semiconductor issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does semiconductors fit into this? Because I think of semiconductors as some little microprocessors, which I guess probably run everything. That's what you're going to tell me. But what does semiconductors have to do with polyolefin demand?
Good question. Well, for polyethylene, it's packaging. It's the packaging, that the wrapping, the shrink film, et cetera, that gets wrapped around the game console you've ordered for Christmas you're not going to get. Or the TV, or the, you know, auto components. For polypropylene, for copolymer impact, it's actually the auto components themselves, because they can't make the cars and some electronics. It's not big for electronics, polypropylene. You know, it's more like polystyrene, isn't it? The styrenics, ABS, et cetera, that's really hit directly. I mean, the other thing is the containers, and literally can't get anything. The cost of moving east to west, as you've seen, to North America is off the charts, isn't it?
It's crazy. I mean, it's gone up by 500%, according to some people.
Yeah. I mean, the latest charts we get from Freightos, who supply data, is just $24,000 for a 440-foot container. And top of the range price, yeah.
So how does that resolve? That's my great mysterious question, quite honestly, is how do the logistics challenges get resolved to basically allow some of this flow, to allow the demand to be met, et cetera? Or maybe when does it get resolved? What do you see and what are you guys predicting?
When an expert says something is more than 6 months away from being fixed, it means they don't know. I think that's the latest expert opinion. Of course, I'm not an expert in container freight. Talked to a few people about it who are experts, is that at least till the middle of next year, before it's resolved. This was supposed to be resolved by Q2 this year, wasn't it? That's what people were saying. Even by the Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year, the end of February, they were talking about initially, I think. And I think the problem is, they say that they're busy making enough containers to meet this huge increase in global trade. So this massive China boom.
Yeah.
So other people, and they're saying, no, there's still log jams of supply of containers and container ships because of this huge increase in global trade, people in lockdowns, etc. The other thing is the positioning of the containers. And I never really had to worry about this before. it's worked, didn't it?
Right, because they were plentiful.
Yeah.
Right? They were where they needed to be. Yeah.
Where they needed to be is the key point. And it's about having exactly the right number of containers. You know, not too many containers in one place, not too few in other places. And it only takes a slight disruption in the global port system to make that imbalance worse, which is already there. So the Tsushan port was shut down in China a couple of weeks ago. You've probably read about it. And it's the fourth biggest container port in the world. And Yantian port was shut down in May, 3 terminals at Yantian in Guangdong. And the terminal ports, these terminals are enormous. And so it causes all this backlog of ships in the wrong places. And I think, personally, what concerns me is, okay, we might eventually get enough containers. We're getting there, I think, producing them.
Right.
But until or unless the world is fully vaccinated, we're going to get this Delta or even Gamma version of the disease that's going to get out, more infectious, and cause port disruptions.
Yeah. So this is interesting, John, because I know you've written about this, and obviously you're talking about this, that you see that the COVID vaccination rates are playing a significant effect on demand, particularly in developing worlds, which are lower vaccinated or have lower rates at this point. But does it get resolved, right? I mean, so there's some that say, right, so the reason for vaccination and pushing higher vaccination rates is around herd immunity. Herd immunity can also be met to some degree by developing natural resistance, right? Which basically means people get infected and then have to recover from it, et cetera. And yet the developing world in particular has locked down so tightly because they don't have the capabilities within their healthcare system. But nor do they have the vaccination. There's this whole big resolution that needs to happen without a clear path at this point.
Sadly, you're right. You're right in terms of vaccinations are not everything. But the problem is we've got a lot of comorbidities in the developing world. So in a healthy Western population, obviously obesity is a big problem in Australia. But,
yeah, the US as well. Yeah.
But yeah, we eat too much rather than eat too little. We don't have, you know, endemic dysentery like you have in places like India. So the problem is that, you know, that to let it rip, it would be horrendous.
Right.
Because of those comorbidities. Whereas to let it rip in poorer communities in the developed world is a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. We're trying to prevent that, obviously, with different strategies in different regions.
Yeah. So that's why they have to have these severe lockdowns, because they haven't got the healthcare to cope with. I mean, it's difficult in the developed world to cope, isn't it, sometimes? So I don't know how it's resolved until or unless we reach herd immunity.
So how big of an impact does this make on demand? When we think about global demand, is this a 5%, 10%, 20% impact?
Good question. I mean, I've done some modeling for polypropylene HDP recently on the blog. And we're looking at, I'm assuming, lower growth in China because of logistics issue, but growth picks up in China. So basically what I see is like polypro growth this year will be about 300,000 tons versus what we expect to be a few million tons this year, but it's 2.3. And then I see China growth being quite healthy after that, really. So 5, 6% to 2025. But then what I did is I assumed a second year of negative growth in the developing world rather than our base case V-shaped recovery. And I saw that in 2023 again on the basis that there's an American research institute, Duke, I think it is, who the developing world will be fully vaccinated in 2023. So let's assume that's going to happen, right? So it all swings back healthily. And you get a strong recovery in the developing world. You get this pent-up demand, right, which you always get. So, but you see global growth of 3% per annum rather than 5% base case, you know?
Yeah. Although, will the developing world have the money, given that they've been locked down and not working and just kind of the whole economics, will they have the money to be able to rebound?
I'm being optimistic. Yeah.
Okay. You have to assume they do at some point.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah.
They will catch up. Yeah. The other thing is, though, I mean, it's the China monster which really makes a difference. Because, you know, with polypro, we'd expect a 9%, 10% growth this year. It's about 1%, 2% for China. That's massive because China's 43% of global demand, you know.
Yeah, that's a huge growth, just absolute growth. Yeah.
I mean, compared with 2019, China's still massively ahead. It's a few million tons ahead. So it shows that 2020 was a bubble year, you know. So that's nothing to really panic about. It's just that this export problem there. I should say as well, really importantly, it says the extra supply, which I haven't talked about. So you've got Chinese polypropylene capacity going up 13%. So it looks like now imports this year will be about 4.8 million tons versus 6.6 last year.
So a 50% drop.
Yeah. China's becoming an export player, polypropylene.
That's different.
Yeah. I mean, 970,000 tons of exports in the first 7 months of this year versus 470,000 the whole of last year.
And where's most of those exports going?
Good question. A lot to Vietnam because they've got a free trade deal. So that's within Asia. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. But to the United States a little bit, despite the logistics barriers, despite all the concern about price fluctuations and, of course, containers, Brazil, Peru, and then you should see, because China's getting more towards self-sufficiency and because of the weaker growth, South Korea's been exporting a lot more to the US. Well, a lot more, a little bit more. And Saudi and Singapore, because they're the big exporters to China normally. So big capacity this year in polypropylene HDPE. And it's both China driving that as they puff towards self-sufficiency in some products. And South Korea's adding a lot.
So it's interesting. So this China self-sufficiency, one, is it real? And then what products will it be true? And then two, I guess, what's the effect on producers in other regions? What happens?
Again, very good questions. Polypropylene is the big one. As I said, you know, looking at maybe 4.8 million tons of imports this year, 6.6. You play around with that data, and you can get to a point by 2025 where China is a net exporter. Now, that's been a bit silly. That's kind of throwing in all the, you know, the unconfirmed projects and assuming a high operating rate. So I do that just to shock people, just to make them think, plan, you know.
Yeah.
I think what's going to happen is China will probably be importing copolymer for a long time, you know, but it's going to be a couple of million tons sort of thing, I think. And they'll be a net exporter in HOMO, very much so. So what does it mean? Well, it means the peoples like the SABICs and the RAMCOs are going to find a home for that polypropylene elsewhere. And South Korea, Singapore, Thailand, Taiwan, who really be exporters to China, big six, as I call them.
Yeah.
And polypropylene is not quite as unbalanced as polyethylene, right? polypropylene only 43% of net imports go to China in 2020, whereas polyethylene was 69%, right?
Hmm.
So the good news with polyethylene is, I think, over the long term, they're going to struggle to get anywhere close to, any much closer to self-sufficiency. So if you look at our data out to 2031, I do some silly aggressive downsize just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And you're still importing 13 million tons of linear low by 2031 versus 15 million tons in the upside. So that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fine. So it really is polypropylene. And it really is, you know, luckily it's not as skewed towards China as polyethylene. So that's good news. So it's a case of South Koreans are adding capacity this year. Like I said, you look at Turkey, look at Europe, look at Latin America, look at that disparate kind of very difficult market of Africa with all different customs regulations. And
yeah,
it adds up to an okay figure, but it's difficult to navigate, isn't it?
It's not easy to navigate, not at all.
No. And you need to go through traders. So therefore, it's expensive. You're leaving money to the traders, aren't you? It's not like.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you tell me about the US. That's fascinating. You know, you've got this dependence on refinery propylene. Now, relative to polyethylene, of course, you've got very little investment.
Right.
Will it become a significant import market given the logistics constraints, you know, the rail cars?
In some ways, I would say that's been a deliberate barrier, right? I mean, so if you go back a decade or more ago, there was potential investment. There was some real focus on importing product into the U.S. And that's when the U.S. was looking to be short and needed to create that import infrastructure. Because, of course, the U.S., as you know, the logistics of the U.S. polymers markets are very different than the rest of the world, right? It is a bulk market. Whereas when you are moving product elsewhere in the world, in Asia and Africa and where else, it's bagged and containerized, right? So it's a very different logistics handling system. And yet, you know, if the price is right, there's always a way to overcome it.
Right.
But the U.S. has not significantly invested in polypropylene. It's been an ethane polyethylene market to a large degree.
Yeah.
And then, of course, where the propylene is coming in, it's through PDH, right? Because there is a lot of propane, right? And we're seeing propane exports and stuff, but we're not seeing that direct investment in polypropylene. It's almost as if the U.S. players have decided to just cede that market because they don't think it's long-term profitable in the way that they would like.
Yeah, of course, the margins on ethane and polyethylene are huge. Recently, they've been humongous. They've been fantastic, haven't they? If you've been operating, of course.
Yeah, if you've been operating.
Which is a big issue. Because that's been a big...
Now, I think people are recovering after... That storm really hurt a lot, right? That storm in February hurt producers quite a lot. And so one of the things you talked about, John, earlier is how the markets have become a bit more regionalized, right? And so prices are pretty high in US and Europe, much lower in Asia and China. And for a long time, there was a view that the markets would equalize to a large degree. Where do you see that going? Is this dislocation of pricing temporary or, you know, is something else going on?
We're on the future now, aren't we? We're going to predict the future. I think it's here to stay. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Unless, so basically it's exports, potential exports from Asia bouncing off a container freight wall. As somebody described to me a few weeks ago, it's a nice way of putting it. The stuff getting out. Talked about the China exports to Brazil and Peru, South Korea more to the US. So they are finding ways. There's arbitrage because the price differentials are so huge despite the freight issues. But relatively speaking, as you say, prices are not equalizing them the way they normally do. The only thing I think that would, you know, turn it is if we start seeing operating rate cuts in Asia, bring prices up. And looking at our variable margin reports that we do weekly on all the grades, it's all right. It's not great. I mean, Asia's always well behind in the US anyway, but the great advantage of Asia is volume, isn't it?
Yes. They've set a different target for margins. And I mean, there's different prioritizations. And I think the level of accuracy about what's actually being produced is very different as well.
Yeah. And also decisions on production are different.
Very different.
Social, political stuff drive it. So, I mean, we could look at our variable cost margins and say, ooh, turn negative, we'll see big operating rate cuts. We did actually see that in late 2019. If you do remember, in a lifetime away, late 2019.
It was a long time ago, wasn't it? Yeah.
This is the industry down cycle, wasn't it? This is when overcapacity of polyethylene from the US was going to drive everything down.
Yeah, the market was going to tank and the world was going to be awash in plastics.
And then we saw those negative margins, I think, in November, December, January, and big operating rate cuts and prices came up in February. Then, bang, the pandemic arrives, changes everything. So I suppose potentially you could see that same. But at the moment, our margins are saying they're okay. They're actually in Southeast Asia. They've picked up a bit recently. Of course, the issue is volume. That margins are equal volume. So we do have a proxy for volume called the plant cost evaluator. So I'm advertising here that we launched recently, which gives you an idea of proxy for sort of short-term demand in the key polyethylene, polypropylene. And that looks, you need to watch that to see if that black line, it's like a cost curve starts moving to the left, and we know then that plants are shutting down, combined with margins. But the moment looks all right. Mm. With the freight issue not being resolved, you think the price differentials are here to stay, I think,
Yeah, at least for, I guess, a period of time for the next, however long it takes until that freight gets resolved. Because it will get resolved eventually.
Oh, yeah, eventually, yeah.
Interesting. So let's turn a little bit and talk about sustainability and circularity. Certainly, you know, where I sit in the U.S., I am seeing announcements, it seems like daily, from, you know, major petrochemical producers, the plastics industry, consumer products companies, you name it, about sustainability goals, technical advancements in mechanical and chemical recycling, which seems to be the holy grail at the moment, and then alliances. How is this going to affect the polyethylene and polypropylene market? Do you see these recycled products or just this drive towards sustainability and circularity? And there's talk of taxes on virgin resin and stuff. What influence do you see this having on the market?
Well, I'm going to use the same thing when a divided world again. Same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to correct carbon with it as well, which I know, of course, is a separate issue, but it, you know, to do with the whole sustainability thing. If you look at the IOCs, they've got to walk the talk. You know, Shell lost a court case in the Netherlands. Chevron, Exxon, got those activist investors, as you know.
Yep.
So they're having to be more aggressive in reducing carbon, and they're getting pressure from the brand owners, the legislators to, you know, Europe especially, and you're saying in the US now as well, to step up the game and recycling. So they're going to struggle to meet the huge demand growth in the developing world, which is going to come back post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the data, it's extraordinary. We need to revise it and push it out because of what I've been saying. But polyethylene demand in the developed world is going to grow about 14% over the next 10 years, 11 years, 92% of the developing world, right?
Wow.
Including China. So they're motivated to really walk the talk on recycling and carbon, right? So it limits their ability to expand into the only way we can meet demand, in my view, which is virgin production. Chemical recycling is the holy grail, but you do the maths and it doesn't give you enough feedstock. It's tiny. You'd have to build, I worked out a thing, to build to replace one 1.5 million ton a year cracker, you need more than 400 chemical recycling plants.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ridiculous because, you know, 3.3 tons of naphtha makes one ton of ethylene. And, you know, do that calculation, 10,000 tons a year, 20,000 tons maximum, maybe for a recycling plant. They're all small units next to landfills. So you've got all logistics issues. There was talk about scaling up to 400,000 tons for one plant, but you need 17 million people, plastic rubbish from 17 million people to supply that 400,000 ton plant. So imagine the trucks arriving in a chemical site every day. So that's in a country like the United States with a good road system, getting better with the infrastructure. But, you know, you've got good roads. Developing world, it's just complete pie in the sky. You've got people who haven't got roads.
Right.
Oh, really poor roads. And you've got sort of like Indonesia with all these thousands of islands spread around. They've got the geographical issues. So the chemical recycling is never going to produce. And the simple law of people moving out of poverty is driving demand for polyethylene. You've got to supply it. So I see the NOCs in a strong position because they're not facing the same pressure to build steam crackers. And they're still building refineries because electrification is an issue in Europe.
Right.
In the developing world, it's your own, you buy your first motor scooter, it's going to be run on petrol, gasoline. And the IOCs are not going to vote for Christmas. Not Turkey's voting for Christmas in that they're going to push oil into transportation still because they have to sell oil.
Mm.
And what kind of frustrates me, sorry, Victoria, is The problem is how we chuck it away, right?
Yes.
And there were 3 billion people in the developing world, as the NOCs, the non-profits keep telling us, who either don't have adequate rubbish collection systems or have no bin men at all. So I've been backpacking through Indonesia. And you see people throwing plastic waste into the open environment, not because they want to, but because there's no collection system.
Mm.
So we need bin men. And I hate to say this because, you know, people in the EU will say, how dare you say this? We need landfills. Landfills are better than the alternative of letting it into the natural environment. So what we're going to see, I think, is that people will realize, made all these investments in recycling in Europe, and that's good, chemical, mechanical, and that's becoming an important part of the market, and it will be. But we haven't solved the problem of plastic waste in the oceans because there's 9 rivers, or is it 11 rivers?
10 is the number I always hear. So it's somewhere in between.
10, you're right. 10, sorry, I'm wrong. And 90% of the plastic rubbish in the oceans comes from those 10 rivers, all of which are in the developing world, 8 in Asia, 2 in Africa.
Yeah.
So this is the core problem. And that's about the Alliance Against Plastic Waste, which, of course, you've probably heard of, you know, the industry body.
Yeah, absolutely. Great organization.
Great. That's what they're pushing. Let's give people bin men.
Mm.
So I think we're going to get a point where we see a lot of investment in the West, a lot of brand owner pressure, you know, right down to the people shopping in the supermarkets saying, I don't want plastic waste issue. We've seen the David Attenborough film, Blue Planet 2. It's very emotional. But we're not going to solve the problem until we deal with bin men, basically. And we'll get to that point eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, that's a long...
No, that's good. It's interesting because, again, I mean, I recognize the challenges that you talk about. And in fact, that's something I think about, is the fact that I'm recycling and handling my plastic and reducing my plastic doesn't change what's going on the ocean, because my products, my plastic products that I use, aren't ending up there anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
It's coming from areas where there's less focus. It's a bit of a conundrum, and this is one that I have found across the industry over a variety of topics. And it's not really necessarily about the chemical industry. It's about the broader government and just influences that we have this focus on the Western world, the US, Europe, North and South America, fixing these problems, holding itself to higher and higher standards. It becomes more costly to produce products. There was legitimately, I just saw this month, a couple of weeks ago, a congressman or senator, somebody in the US proposing a 20-cent per pound tax on resin to cover infrastructure and recycling and make it more difficult. It's like, well, okay, that's great. It's not going to work. It's not the right answer, but it doesn't solve the world's problems, because the world somehow has to come together to solve this. And one region fixing it doesn't solve global warming, doesn't solve it for all the other rest of the world. It doesn't solve plastics in the ocean, et cetera. So it's challenging. And so one of the things I find interesting, and just coming back to just the economics and the affordability, and you've touched on this. So, you know, the NOCs are still investing. They're investing in refineries, they're investing in petrochemicals. They're doing this with probably less environmental controls. The IOCs, the publicly held companies in US and Europe, are under much more pressure, right? They're all seeding and setting these very aggressive targets on carbon and on plastics recycling and reduction, et cetera, targeting 2030. And yet it's going to have an economic effect. And the economic effect is that, you know, if you're following all these constraints, your cost of production, cost of goods sold, is going up, whereas others are not. How do you see this? Or, you know, have you looked at this in terms of how it changes demand, growth, et cetera, just based on the sheer economics of these influence of these different regimes?
I think the US, of course, have got a lot of polyethylene they're adding, which is very competitive. So they're in a good position. That's okay.
So even with higher costs, they're still good.
I think that's okay. Should be okay. But there will be a need for investment to meet that demand growth. And you can see that investment being concentrated in the developing world. And we haven't looked at it in terms of, you know, sort of cost modeling it. But I think I was speaking to a client in Asia a few weeks ago. Should we go into specialty chemicals? Should we go into copolymer PP and the rest of it? I said, nah, just make commodity polyethylene. If you got the feedstock, you'd be all right. And I think what we will see is tremendous demand growth for those commodities and difficulty in meeting it.
Mm.
Well, they will be met, but the investments will be in the developing world to meet it. Yeah. Obviously, the feedstock issue is there for the Middle East with the lack of gas.
Yep.
But we are building these mega refineries to meet transportation fuels demand still largely. That's where you build the refineries. And you can try and increase the petchem ratio, can't you? It's still mainly a refinery transportation machines. China's building still more mega refineries. So I just basically see the demand being met in the developing world by the developing world.
Got it. Leading to this whole self-sufficiency or a closer degree of self-sufficiency as we see the China approaching and then elsewhere, I guess.
I mean, US is fascinating. Tell me, I mean, you've got all this ethane. You've had all this ethane. Will you carry on having all this ethane? And will you be able to exploit it because of the environmental issues? Build more polyethylene?
Yeah. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge. And so far, the ethane, and I think the petchem industry in the US has been able to manage that. But we're seeing knock-on effects in other things. And I think energy in many ways is an early indicator of some of this, right? So there's this whole desire to go to green energy, wind, and et cetera. And there is a lot of conflict around land use, right? And and so it kind of falls into the same category, I think, right? There's a desire to be more green. There's a desire to continue to develop and invest and leverage the natural resources we have. But then there's also a conflict because people say, not in my backyard.
Right.
And I think the not in my backyard doesn't happen as much in the developing areas, countries, because they're just trying to create jobs and government has more power to influence this, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of balances things out.
Right. But it's interesting with all of the issue about methane, the IPCC report, methane being the big bad enemy. Although cows are more important than petrochemical. That's the problem.
My oldest daughter is vegan and she tells me this, you know, it's about the environment and, you know, fewer cows, less methane. I'm like, oh, okay, that's nice.
Will that constrain the ability of the US to build more steam crackers as we go forward? I don't know.
Who knows? I don't see it right now, but, you know, it's interesting. We've slowed down that pace of growth. I think what's going to be interesting, and a lot of this has to do with administration, right? So with the current administration, permits have slowed. Everything has slowed, right? So everything that's about big corporate investment has an EPA relationship, is about permitting, is about natural resources, has slowed and stalled. And so I think we have to see how this gets resolved. And I know the industry groups are really quite active in trying to engage and educate and help support the chemical position, but it's not clear, right? So it kind of depends on the effects of the administration, which of course can change every 4 years, right? So we don't know. It varies.
Demand is there.
Yeah. The demand is there. People like their plastic.
Yeah.
And everything that goes with it.
Yeah. And the export demand will be there if you can build a supply issue. But I said that that's interesting because the US isn't. We can make use of that ethane, but I think generally speaking, the IOCs will struggle to meet that demand. I mean, if they build in Asia, they've got the same problems. You can't build a site in Asia which is not totally compliant, you know, using green and blue hydrogen and electric furnaces and all that stuff that increases the cost, doesn't it?
Right. They're being held to a different standard.
Yes.
And that's what makes it difficult to compete, is when you're competing and being held to two very different standards.
Yeah.
It's just harder. It's not insurmountable, though, right? We've seen this. This is not new. This is not a new issue.
Hmm.
We've overcome this through the years.
Yes.
And you see that, right? I mean, you see that majors are really working to overcome these barriers. So it's not insurmountable. It's a bit more challenging, requires more science and more engineering and more thought about how that works.
This is years and years away, but if you did have a global trade in green and blue hydrogen, perhaps that's an alternative revenue stream. You know, moving around with ammonia and trading hubs, you can start imagining the world.
Well, and that's right. So I think that's one of the things, you know, and I've talked to a lot of different people about this, that the chemical industry, the energy and chemical industry is inherently creative and problem solvers. And we've figured out how to overcome those challenges through the years and create economic benefit from it, right? So if you just think about just the inherent circularity that already exists in chemicals, right? So many products are made from refinery off streams or chemical off streams, right? So there's this natural tendency and focus on how do you keep reusing and not wasting anything and creating greater value. And so that will come. I think with hydrogen, and I don't profess to understand the difference between green and blue, and not sure I ever will. I need to maybe bring somebody on the podcast to explain the difference to me, because I'm like, thought it was an invisible molecule. Yeah. So, yeah, so stay tuned. We'll find that and make that happen. But yeah, I think it'll all balance out. I mean, I think this is just an entirely moving and evolving business.
That is fascinating. You're right. I mean, you've got the mixed feed cracker technologies, as you say, Exxon can crack Wellington boots, as somebody said to me once, you know.
Yeah.
Cheapest offcuts that you don't want to sell in the market because they won't get you anything, or not much anyway. And all the heat you transfer and all that stuff around the complex. So that means you have the skill set to solve it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
The mindset. Yeah. Okay. That's optimistic. That's nice. That's a very optimistic note.
I am an optimist. Most of the time.
Yeah, I like that.
I think, yeah, you know, there's so you may not be familiar with this. In the US, what was very popular when I was a kid was Schoolhouse Rock. So on Saturdays, we'd watch cartoons and they'd have these little Schoolhouse Rock segments. And my favorite might have been Mother Necessity. So Mother Necessity, where would we be without the focus and ingenuity, right? So basically, we keep solving our problems, coming up with new ways of doing things. And I think that's absolutely true across the industry.
Yeah. Should write a piece of my blog. It's really good. I like that.
There you go. I'll send it to you. I'll find, you know, the little script and I'll send it to you. It's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's good. So John, this has been great. So let me ask one final question. So what are some leading indicators? What are you watching out for in terms of what's going to change and drive the market? And what should we be looking out for over the next 6-12 months that's going to really influence what's going on in the world of polyethylene and polypropylene?
Container freight rates, very simply. And Asian operating rates.
Okay.
I think those are two. And of course, hey, you know, you've got the hurricane season in the Gulf now.
Oh, Lord. Yep. We've been watching closely.
But tell me, I mean, there was supposed to be big concern about power outages in the US during the hot summer, and Texas had a heat surge a few weeks. So you've been all right, haven't you? I think so far.
Yeah, I haven't noticed any issues. Last week, we had a lot of rain. So it was heat up and then we get rain every afternoon, which brings it down. So that there's just some natural cycles, but we haven't, knock on wood, experienced any real issues.
So I suppose it's the supply issues in the Western Hemisphere, freight rates in the middle for everywhere, and Asian operating rates, I think, would be the three things to look out for.
Awesome. Cool. John, this has been great. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do so?
John.Richardson@ICIS.com. That's the best way.
And I personally love following you on LinkedIn. You always have something sharp, insightful to post. So that's always been great too.
Well, I enjoyed the conversation. I enjoy the optimism about the circularity of the industry. That's a really good thought, actually. It's nice.
Yeah. 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 Awesome. Well, thanks, John. And thanks everyone for listening to The Chemical Show.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Victoria.
We've come to the end of today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed your time with us and want to learn more. Simply visit thechemicalshow.com for additional information and helpful resources. Join us again next time here on The Chemical Show with Victoria Meyer.